2. Duchess. When it came to vaudeville, it was all about the setup. That was as true for the comedians as it was for the jugglers and magicians. The members of the audience entered the theater with their own preferences, their own prejudices, their own sets of expectations. So without the audience members realizing it, the performer needed to remove those and replace them with a new set of expectations. A set of expectations that he was in a better position to anticipate, manipulate, and ultimately satisfy. Take Mandrake the Magnificent. Manny wasn't what you'd call a great magician. In the first half of his act, he'd produce a bouquet of flowers out of his sleeve, or colored ribbons out of his ears, or a nickel out of thin air. Basically the stuff you'd see at a 10-year-old's birthday party. But like Kazantikas, what Manny lacked in the front of his act, he made up for in the finale. One difference between Mandrake and most of his peers was that rather than having some leggy blonde at his side, he had a large white cockatoo named Lucinda. Many years before, while traveling in the Amazon, Manny would explain to the audience, he had discovered a baby bird that had fallen from her nest to the forest floor. After nursing the chick back to health, he had raised her to adulthood, and they had been together ever since. Over the course of the act, Lucinda would perch on her gilded stand and assist by holding a set of keys in her claws or rapping 3 times on a deck of cards with her beak. But when the act was winding up, Manny would announce that he was going to attempt a trick he had never performed before. A stagehand would wheel out a pedestal on which sat a black enamel chest, illustrated with a big red dragon. On a recent trip to the Orient, Manny would say, he had discovered the object in a flea market. The moment he saw it, he recognized it for what it was, a mandarin's box. Manny knew only a bit of Chinese, but the old man who was selling the curiosity not only confirmed Manny's suspicions, he went on to teach Manny the magic words that made it work. Tonight, Manny would announce, for the first time anywhere in the Americas, I will use the mandarin's box to make my trusted cockatoo vanish and reappear right before your eyes. Gently, Manny would place Lucinda in the chest and shut the doors. Closing his eyes, he would utter an incantation in a Chinese of his own invention while tapping the chest with his wand. When he reopened the doors, the bird was gone. After bowing for a round of applause, Manny would ask for silence, explaining that the spell to make the bird reappear was far more complicated than the one that made it vanish. Taking a deep breath, he would double up on his oriental mumbo-jumbo, working it to a suitable pitch. Then opening his eyes, he would point his wand. Seemingly from nowhere, a ball of fire would explode and engulf the chest, prompting the audience to gasp and Manny to take 2 steps back. But once the smoke had cleared, there was the mandarin's box without so much as a scratch. Stepping forward, tentatively, Manny would open the doors of the chest, reach his hands inside, and withdraw a platter, on which sat a perfectly roasted bird surrounded by all the fixings. For a moment, the magician and audience would share the silence of the stunned. Then raising his gaze from the platter, Manny would look out into the theater and say, "Oops!" How that would bring down the house. So, here's what happened on Sunday, the 20th of June. Having woken at the crack of dawn, at Wooly's insistence, we packed our bags, tiptoed down the back stairs, and slipped out the door without making a sound. After putting the caddy in neutral and rolling her out of the drive, we fired her up, put her in gear, and half an hour later we were sailing up the Taconic State Parkway like Ali Baba on his magic carpet. What cars were on the road all seemed to be headed in the opposite direction, so we were making good time, passing through LaGrangeville by 7 o'clock and Albany by 8. After being given the business by his brother-in-law, Wooly had tossed and turned for most of the night and woken up looking as low as I'd ever seen him. So when I saw a blue steeple on the horizon, I put on the blinker. Being back in the bright orange booth seemed to lift his spirits. Though he didn't seem as interested in his placemat, he ate almost half of his pancakes and all of my bacon. Not long after we passed Lake George, Wooly had me turn off the highway, and we began winding our way through the great bucolic wilderness that makes up 90% of New York's landmass and none of its reputation. With the townships getting farther apart and the trees getting closer to the road, Wooly almost seemed himself, humming along with the commercials, even though the radio wasn't on. It must have been about 11 when he sat up on the edge of his seat and pointed to a break in the woods.
You take that next right.
Turning onto a dirt road, we began winding our way through a forest of the tallest trees that I had ever seen. To be perfectly honest, when Wooly had first told me about the 150 grand that was stashed in a safe at the family's camp, I had my doubts. I just couldn't seem to picture all that money sitting in some log cabin in the woods. But when we emerged from the trees, rising before us was a house that looked like a hunting lodge owned by the Rockefellers. When Wooly saw it, he breathed an even bigger sigh of relief than I did, as if he'd had his own doubts, like maybe the whole place had been a figment of his imagination. "Welcome home," I said, and he gave me his first smile of the day. When we got out of the car, I followed Wooly around to the front of the house and across the lawn, to where a giant body of water shimmered in the sun.
"The lake," Wooly said.
With the trees coming right down to the shoreline, there wasn't another residence in sight. "How many houses are on this lake?" I asked.
"One?"
he asked back. "Right," I said. Then he began giving me the lay of the land.
"The dock,"
he said, pointing to the dock. "And the boathouse," he said, pointing to the boathouse. "And the flagpole," he said, pointing to the flagpole.
"The caretaker hasn't been here yet," he observed with another sigh of relief.
"How can you tell?"
"Because the raft isn't on the lake, and the rowboats aren't at the dock."
Turning, we took a moment to appreciate the house, which looked down over the water like it had been there since the beginning of America. And maybe it had.
"Perhaps we should get our things," Wooly suggested.
"Allow me." Hopping to it like a bellboy at the Ritz, I skipped over to the car and opened the trunk. Setting aside the Louisville Slugger, I took out our book bags and followed Wooly to the narrow end of the house, where two lines of white-painted stones led to a door. On the top of the stoop were four overturned flower pots. No doubt when the raft was on the lake and the rowboats at the dock, they would be planted with whatever sort of flower that wasps found to be ornamental without being showy. After peeking under three of the pots, Wooly retrieved a key and unlocked the door. Then, showing a decidedly un-Wooly presence of mind, he put the key back where he'd found it before letting us inside. First, we entered a little room in which cubbyholes, hooks, and baskets held an orderly arrangement of everything you'd need for the great outdoors. Coats and hats, rods and reels, bows and arrows. In front of a glass cabinet showcasing four rifles were several large white chairs stacked one on top of the other, having been hauled in from their picturesque spots on the lawn.
"The mudroom," Wooly said,
as if mud had ever found its way onto the shoe of a Wolcott. Over the gun cabinet there was a big green sign like the one in the barracks at Salina, painted with its own rules and regulations. Most everywhere else on the wall, hanging right up to the ceiling, were dark red boards in the shape of chevrons with lists painted in white.
"The winners," Wooly explained.
"Of what?"
"The tournaments we used to have on the 4th of July."
Wooly pointed from one to the other.
"Riflery, archery, the swim race, the canoe race, the 20-yard dash."
As I gazed over the boards, Wooly must have thought I was looking for his name, because he volunteered that it wasn't there.
"I'm not very good at winning," he confessed.
"It's overrated," I assured. Exiting the mudroom, he led me down the hall, naming rooms as we went.
"The tea room, the billiard room, the game closet."
Where the hallway ended, it opened into a large living area.
"We call this the great room," said Wooly.
And they weren't kidding. Like the lobby of a grand hotel, it had six different seating areas, with couches and wingback chairs and standing lamps. There was also a card table topped with baize, and a fireplace that looked like it belonged in a castle. Everything was in its proper place, except for the dark green rocking chairs huddled by the outside doors. Seeing them, Wooly seemed disappointed. "What is it?"
"Those really belong on the porch."
"No time like the present." Setting our bags down and tossing my fedora on a chair, I helped Wooly shuttle the rockers onto the porch, being careful to arrange them, per his instructions, at equal intervals. Once they were all in place, Wooly asked if I wanted to see the rest of the house. "Absolutely," I said, which brought an even bigger smile. "I want to see all of it, Wooly. But we can't forget the reason we're here." After looking at me with curiosity for a moment, Wooly put a finger of recognition in the air. Then he led me down the hallway on the other side of the great room and opened a door.
"My great-grandfather's study," he said.
As we had walked through the house, it seemed laughable I had ever doubted that money could be stashed here. Given the scale of the rooms and the quality of the furnishings, there could have been 50 grand stuffed under a mattress in the maid's room, and another 50 lost among the cushions of the couches. But if the majesty of the house boosted my confidence, that was nothing compared to great-grandpa's study. Here was a room of a man who knew not only how to make money, but how to keep it, which after all are two different things entirely. In some ways, it was like a small version of the great room, with the same wooden chairs and red rugs and another fireplace. But there was also a great big desk, bookcases, and one of those little sets of steps that the bookish used to reach the volumes on upper shelves. On one wall was a painting of a bunch of colonial fellows in tight pants and white wigs gathered around a desk. But over the fireplace was a portrait of a man in his late 50s, with fair coloring and a handsome, decisive-looking face. "Your great-grandfather?" I asked.
"No," said Wooly. "My grandfather."
In a way, I was relieved to hear it. Hanging a portrait of oneself over the fireplace in one's study didn't seem a very Woolcotty thing to do.
"It was painted at the time my grandfather took over for my great-grandfather at the paper company. When he died shortly thereafter, my great-grandfather had it moved here."
Looking from Wooly to the portrait, I could see the family resemblance, except for the decisive part, of course. "What happened to the paper company?" I asked.
"Uncle Wallace took over when Grandpa died. He was only 25 at the time, and he ran it until he was about 30. But then he died too."
I didn't bother observing that the head of the Woolcot Paper Company was a job to be avoided. I suspect Wooly knew that already. Turning, Wooly walked over to the painting of the colonials and held out a hand.
"The presentation of the Declaration of Independence."
"No kidding."
"Oh, yes," said Wooly. "There's John Adams, and Thomas Jefferson, and Ben Franklin, and John Hancock. They're all there."
"Which one's the Woolcot?" I asked with a puckish grin. But taking another step forward, Wooly pointed to a small head at the back of the crowd.
"Oliver," he said. "He also signed the Articles of Confederation and was the governor of Connecticut, though that was 7 generations ago."
We both nodded for a few seconds, in order to give old Ollie his due. Then reaching up, Wooly opened the painting like it was a cabinet door, and lo and behold, there was great-grandpa's safe, looking like it had been fashioned from the metal of a battleship. With a nickel-plated handle and 4 little dials, it must have been 1.5 feet square. If it was also 1.5 feet deep, it would be big enough to hold the life savings of 70 generations of Hewitts. But for the solemnity of the moment, I would have whistled. From great-grandpa's perspective, the contents of the safe were probably an expression of the past. In this grand old house, behind this venerable old painting, were documents that had been signed decades before, jewelry that had been handed down from generation to generation, and cash that had been accumulated over several lifetimes. But in just a few moments, some of the safe's contents would have been transformed into a representation of the future. Emmett's future, Wooly's future, my future.
"There it is," said Wooly.
"There it is," I agreed. and we both let out a sigh. "Would you like to?" I asked, gesturing at the dials.
"What's that? Oh, no. You go right ahead."
"All right," I said, trying to resist the temptation of rubbing my hands together. "Just give me the combination, and I'll do the honors." After a moment of silence, Wooly looked at me with an expression of genuine surprise.
"Combination?" he asked.
Then I laughed. I laughed until my kidneys hurt and the tears poured out of my eyes. Like I said, when it comes to vaudeville, it's all about the setup. Emmett.
"That's a fine job," said Mrs. Whitney. "I really can't thank you enough."
"It was my pleasure," said Emmett. They were standing at the threshold of the baby's room looking at the walls, which Emmett had just finished painting.
"You must be hungry after all that work. Why don't you come down and I'll fix you a sandwich?"
"I'd appreciate that, Mrs. Whitney. Just let me clean up."
"Of course," she said. "But please, call me Sarah."
That morning, Emmett had come downstairs to find that Duchess and Wooly were gone. Having woken in the early hours, they had driven off in the Cadillac, leaving only a note behind. Mr. Whitney was gone too, having headed back to their apartment in the city without taking time for breakfast. And Mrs. Whitney, she was standing in the kitchen dressed in dungarees, her hair pulled back in a kerchief.
"I promised I'd finally finished painting the baby's room," she explained with a look of embarrassment.
It didn't take much convincing for her to let Emmett take over the job. With Mrs. Whitney's approval, Emmett moved the boxes of Wooly's belongings to the garage, stacking them in the spot where the Cadillac had been. With some tools he found in the basement, he took apart the bed and stowed the pieces beside the boxes. When the room was empty, he finished taping the trim, laid the tarp across the floor, stirred the paint, and went to work. When you had the job set up right, with the room clear and the trim taped and the floor protected, painting was peaceful work. It had a rhythm about it that allowed your thoughts to quiet down or fall silent altogether. Eventually, all that you were aware of was the movement of the brush sweeping back and forth, turning the primed white wall to its new shade of blue. When Sally saw what Emmett was doing, she nodded her head in approval.
"You want a hand?"
"I've got it.
You spilled some paint on the tarp over there by the window."
"Yep."
"All right," she said, "just so's you know."
Then Sally looked up and down the hallway with a bit of a frown, as if she were disappointed there wasn't another room that needed painting. She wasn't used to being idle, certainly not as an uninvited guest in another woman's home.
"Maybe I'll take Billy into town," she said. "Find a soda fountain where we can have lunch."
"Sounds like a good idea," agreed Emmett, placing the brush on the rim of the can. "Let me get you some money."
"I think I can afford to buy your brother a hamburger. Besides, the last thing Mrs. Whitney needs now is you tracking paint all through her house."
When Mrs. Whitney went downstairs to make the sandwiches, Emmett brought all the work materials down the back staircase, having checked his shoes twice to make sure there was no paint on the soles. In the garage, he cleaned the brushes, the paint tray, and his hands with turpentine. Then he joined Mrs. Whitney in the kitchen, where a ham sandwich and a glass of milk were waiting on the table. When Emmett sat down, Mrs. Whitney took the chair opposite him with a cup of tea, but nothing to eat.
"I need to go into the city to join my husband," she said, "but I gather from your brother that your car's in the shop and won't be ready until tomorrow."
"That's right," said Emmett.
"In that case, why don't you three stay the night? You can help yourself to what's in the refrigerator for dinner, and in the morning you can lock the door behind you when you go."
"That's very generous of you." Emmett doubted that Mr. Whitney would have welcomed such an arrangement. If anything, he had probably communicated to his wife that he wanted them out of the house as soon as they awoke. Emmett felt his suspicion confirmed when Mrs. Whitney added, almost as an afterthought, that if the phone were to ring, they should leave it unanswered. As Emmett ate, he noticed that in the middle of the table was a folded piece of paper standing upright between the salt and pepper shakers. Following his gaze, Mrs. Whitney acknowledged that it was Wooly's note. When Emmett had first come down in the morning and Mrs. Whitney had told him that Wooly had gone, she had seemed almost relieved by his departure,
but a little worried, too. As she looked at the note, the same emotions returned to her face. "Would you like to read it?" she asked.
"I wouldn't presume."
"That's all right. I'm sure Willie wouldn't mind."
Emmett's normal instinct would have been to demur a second time, but he sensed that Mrs. Whitney wanted him to read the note. Putting down his sandwich, he took it from its slot between the shakers. Written in Wooly's hand and addressed to Sis, the note said that Wooly was sorry for muddling things up. Sorry about the napkins and the wine. Sorry about the phone and the drawer. Sorry to be leaving so early in the morning without having the chance to say a proper goodbye. But she shouldn't worry. Not for a minute, not for a moment, not for the blink of an eye. All would be well. Cryptically, he concluded the note with the postscript, "The Comptons ate their cabbage in the kitchen."
"Will it?" Mrs. Whitney asked when Emmett set the note down on the table.
"I'm sorry? Will all be well?"
"Yes," replied Emmett.
"I'm sure it will."
Mrs. Whitney nodded, but Emmett could see that this was less an expression of agreement with his reply than of gratitude for his reassurance. For a moment, she looked down into her tea, which must have been tepid by now.
"My brother wasn't always in trouble," she said. "He was Wooly, of course, but things changed for him during the war. Somehow, when Father accepted his commission in the Navy, it was Wooly who ended up at sea."
She smiled a little sadly at her own witticism. Then she asked if Emmett knew why her brother had been sent to Salina.
"He told us once that he had taken someone's car."
"Yes," she said with a bit of a laugh. "That was it, more or less. It happened when Wooly was at St. George's, his third boarding school in as many years. One spring day in the middle of classes," she explained, "he decided to walk into town in search of an ice cream cone, of all things. When he arrived at the little shopping center a few miles from campus, he noticed there was a fire truck parked at the curb. Having looked around and found no signs of any firemen, he became convinced, in a way that only my brother can become convinced, that it must have been forgotten. Forgotten like, oh, I don't even know, like an umbrella on the back of a chair, or a book on the seat of a bus." With a smile of affection, she shook her head, then continued. Eager to return the fire truck to its rightful owners, Wooly climbed behind the wheel and went looking for the station house. Around the town he drove with a fireman's hat on his head, as it was later reported, tooting the horn for any children he passed. After circling for God knows how long, he found a station house, parked the engine, and walked all the way back to campus. The affectionate smile that Mrs. Whitney had been wearing began to fade now, as her mind leapt forward to all that followed. As it turned out, the fire truck had been in the parking lot of the shopping center because several of the firemen were in the grocery store. And while Wooly was driving around, a call came in for a stable that was on fire. By the time the engine from a neighboring town arrived, the stable had burned to the ground. Thankfully, there were no people hurt. But the young stablehand who was on duty alone couldn't get all of the horses out of the building, and four of them died in the fire. The police tracked Wooly back to the school, and that was that. After a moment, Mrs. Whitney pointed to Emmett's plate in order to ask if he was finished. When he said that he was, she cleared it along with her cup to the sink. She was trying not to imagine it, thought Emmett, trying not to imagine those four horses trapped in their stalls, whinnying and rising on their hind legs as the flames grew closer, trying not to imagine the unimaginable. Though her back was now to Emmett, he could tell from the movement of her arm that she was wiping away tears. Deciding that he should leave her in peace, Emmett tucked Wooly's note back in its spot and quietly pushed back his chair. "Do you know what I find so strange?" Mrs. Whitney asked, still standing at the sink with her back to Emmett. When he didn't respond, she turned, wearing a mournful smile. "When we're young, so much time is spent teaching us the importance of keeping our vices in check, our anger, our envy, our pride. But when I look around, it seems to me that so many of our lives end up being hampered by a virtue instead. If you take a trait that by all appearances is a merit, a trait that is praised by pastors and poets, a trait that we have come to admire in our friends and hope to foster in our children, and you give it to some poor soul in abundance, it will almost certainly prove an obstacle to their happiness. Just as someone can be too smart for their own good, there are those who are too patient for their own good, or too hard-working. After shaking her head, Mrs. Whitney looked at the ceiling. When she looked down again, Emmett could see that another tear was making its way down her cheek. Those who are too confident, or too cautious, or too kind. Emmett understood that what Mrs. Whitney was sharing with him was her effort to understand, to explain, to make some sense of the undoing of her big-hearted brother. At the same time, Emmett suspected that tucked in Mrs. Whitney's list was an apology for her husband, who was either too smart, too confident, or too hard-working for his own good. Perhaps all three. But what Emmett found himself wondering was what virtue did Mrs. Whitney have too much of? The answer, his instincts told him, though he was almost reluctant to admit it, was probably forgiveness. Wooly. "And this was my favorite rocking chair," said Wooly to no one. He was standing on the porch, a little while after Duchess had gone to the general store. Giving the chair a push, he listened to the thwapping of its rockers as it rocked back and forth, noting how each individual thwap came closer and closer together as the back and forths became smaller and smaller until they stopped altogether. Setting the chair in motion again, Wooly looked out at the lake. For the time being, it was so still you could see every cloud in the sky reflected on its surface. But in another hour or so, right around 5 o'clock, the afternoon breeze would begin to pick up, and the surface would ripple, and all the reflections would be swept away. Then the curtains in the windows would start to stir. Sometimes, thought Wooly, sometimes at the end of summer, when the hurricanes roamed the Atlantic, the afternoon breeze would grow so strong that the bedroom doors would all slam shut, and the rocking chairs would rock themselves. After giving one last push to his favorite chair, Wooly went back through the double doors into the great room. "And this is the great room," he said, "where we would play Parcheesi and complete jigsaw puzzles on rainy afternoons. And this is the hallway. And this is the kitchen, where Dorothy made fried chicken and her famous blueberry muffins. And that's the table where we ate when we were too young to dine in the dining room." Removing from his pocket the note that he had written while sitting at his great-grandfather's desk, Wooly tucked it neatly between the salt and pepper shakers. Then he left the kitchen by means of the only door in the house that swung back and forth. "And here is the dining room," he said, gesturing to the long table around which his cousins and aunts and uncles would gather. "Once you were old enough to eat in here," he explained, "you could sit in any seat you wanted, as long as it wasn't the seat at the end of the table, because that's where great-grandpa would sit. And there's the head of the moose." Exiting the other dining room door, Wooly re-entered the great room, where after admiring it from corner to corner, he picked up Emmett's book bag and began climbing the stairs, counting as he went. 2, 4, 6, 8, who do we appreciate? At the top of the stairs, the hallway shot off in both directions, east and west, with bedroom doors on either side. While there was nothing hanging on the wall to the south, on the wall to the north were photographs everywhere you looked. According to family legend, Wooly's grandmother had been the first person to hang a photograph in the upstairs hallway, a picture of her four young children, which she put right above the side table opposite the stairs. Soon after, a second and third photograph were hung to the left and right of the first photograph, then a fourth and fifth were hung above and below. Over the years, photographs had been added leftward and rightward, upward and downward, until they radiated in every direction. Setting down the book bag, Wooly approached the first photograph, then began looking at all the others in the order that they had been hung. There was the picture of Uncle Wallace as a little boy in his little sailor suit, and there the picture of his grandfather out on the dock with the tattoo of the schooner on his arm, getting ready to take his 12 o'clock swim. And there the picture of his father, holding up his blue ribbon after winning the riflery contest on the 4th of July in 1941.
He always won the riflery contest, said Wooly, while brushing a tear from his cheek with the flat of his hand.
And there, one step farther from the side table, was the one of Wooly with his mother and father in the canoe. This picture was taken, Wooly didn't know for sure, but around the time that he was 7, certainly before Pearl Harbor and the aircraft carrier, before Richard and Dennis, before St. Paul's and St. Mark's and St. George's, before. The funny thing about a picture, thought Wooly, is that while it knows everything that's happened up until the moment it's been taken, it knows absolutely nothing about what will happen next. And yet, once the picture has been framed and hung on a wall, what you see when you look at it closely are all the things that were about to happen. All the unthings. The things that were unanticipated and unintended and unreversible. Wiping another tear from his cheek, Wooly removed the photograph from the wall and picked up the book bag. As with the chairs around the dining room table, there was one bedroom on the hallway that you weren't allowed to sleep in because it was great-grandpa's. Everyone other than great-grandpa would sleep in different bedrooms at different times depending on how old they were or whether they were married or how early or late in the summer they happened to arrive. Over the years, Wooly had slept in a number of these rooms. But for the longest time, or what seemed like the longest time, he and his cousin Freddie had slept in the second-to-last room on the left. So that's where Wooly went. Stepping inside, Wooly set down the book bag and leaned the photograph of him and his parents on the bureau behind the pitcher and glasses. After looking at the pitcher for a moment, he carried it down the hall to the bathroom, filled it with water, and brought it back. Pouring water into one of the glasses, he picked it up and moved it to the bedside table. Then after opening a window so that the breeze could find its way into the room after 5, he began to unpack. First he took out the radio and placed it on the bureau beside the pitcher. Then he took out his dictionary and placed it beside the radio. Then he took out the cigar box, in which he kept his collection of the same version of different things, and placed it beside the dictionary. Then he took out his extra bottle of medicine, and the little brown bottle that he'd found waiting for him in the spice rack, and placed them on the bedside table beside the glass of water. As he was taking off his shoes, Wooly heard the sound of a car pulling into the driveway. Duchess, returning from the general store. Moving to the doorway, Wooly listened to the screen door in the mudroom open and close. Then footsteps passing through the great room. Then furniture being moved in the study. And finally, the sound of clanging. It wasn't a dainty sort of clanging, like that of a cable car in San Francisco, thought Wooly. It was an emphatic clanging, like that of a blacksmith who's beating a red-hot horseshoe on an anvil. Or perhaps not a horseshoe, thought Wooly with a pang. Better that it was a blacksmith beating something else. Something like a sword. Yes, that was it. The clanging sounded like an ancient blacksmith hammering on the blade of Excalibur. With that happier image in mind, Wooly closed the door, switched on the radio, and went to lie down on the bed on the left. In the story of Goldilocks and the Three Bears, Goldilocks has to climb into 3 different beds before she finds the one that's just right for her. But Wooly didn't need to climb into 3 different beds because he already knew that the one on the left would be just right for him. For as in his youth, it was neither too hard nor too soft, too long nor too short. Propping up the pillows, Wooly polished off the extra bottle of his medicine and made himself comfortable. As he looked up at the ceiling, his thoughts returned to the jigsaw puzzles that they would complete on rainy days. Wouldn't it have been wonderful, thought Wooly, if everybody's life was like a piece in a jigsaw puzzle? Then no one person's life would ever be an inconvenience to anyone else's. It would just fit snugly in its very own specially designed spot, and in so doing would enable the whole intricate picture to become complete. As Wooly was having this wonderful notion, a commercial came to its end, and the telecast of a mystery show began. Climbing back out of bed, Wooly turned the volume on the radio down to 2.5. The important thing to understand about listening to a mystery show on the radio, Wooly knew well, is that all the parts designed to make you anxious, like the whispering of assassins, or the rustling of leaves, or the creaking of steps on a staircase, were relatively quiet, while the parts designed to set your mind at ease, like the sudden epiphany of the hero, or the peeling of his tires, or the crack of his pistol, were relatively loud. So if you turned the volume down to 2.5, you could barely hear the parts designed to make you anxious, while still getting to hear all the parts designed to set your mind at ease. Returning to his bed, Wooly poured all the little pink pills from the little brown bottle onto the table. With the tip of his finger, he pushed them into the palm of his hand, saying, 1 potato, 2 potato, 3 potato, 4, 5 potato, 6 potato, 7 potato, more. Then washing them down with a big drink of water, he made himself comfortable again. With the pillows properly propped, the volume properly lowered, and the little pink pills properly swallowed, you might think that Wooly wouldn't know what to think about, what with Wooly being Wooly and prone to all the old Wooly ways. But Wooly knew exactly what to think about. He had known that he would think about it almost as soon as it had happened. "I'll start in front of the cabinet at F.A.O. Schwartz," he said to himself with a smile, "and my sister will come, and we'll have tea at the plaza with the panda. And after Duchess meets me at the statue of Abraham Lincoln, he and I will attend the circus, where Billy and Emmett will suddenly reappear. Then we'll go over the Brooklyn Bridge and up the Empire State Building, where we'll meet Professor Abernathy. Then it's off to the grassy train tracks, where sitting by the fire, we'll hear the story of the two Ulysses and the ancient seer who explained how they could find their ways home again, how they could find their ways home after 10 long years. But one mustn't rush, thought Wooly, as the window curtains stirred and the grass began to sprout through the seams between the floorboards and the ivy climbed the legs of the bureau. For a one-of-a-kind kind of day deserves to be relived at the slowest possible pace, with every moment, every twist, every turn of events remembered to the tiniest detail. Abacus. Many years before, Abacus had come to the conclusion that the greatest of heroic stories have the shape of a diamond on its side. Beginning at a fine point, the life of the hero expands outward through youth as he begins to establish his strengths and fallibilities, his friendships and enmities. Proceeding into the world, he pursues exploits in grand company, accumulating honors and accolades. But at some untold moment, the two rays that define the outer limits of this widening world of hail companions and worthy adventurers simultaneously turn a corner and begin to converge. The terrain our hero travels, the cast of characters he meets, the sense of purpose that has long propelled him forward, all begin to narrow toward that fixed and inexorable point that defines his fate. Take the tale of Achilles. In hopes of making her son invincible, the Nereid Thetis holds her newborn boy by the ankle and dips him into the river Styx. From that finite moment in time and pinch of the fingers, the story of Achilles begins. As a strapping young lad, he is educated in history, literature, and philosophy by the centaur Chiron. On the fields of sport, he gains in strength and agility, and with his comrade Patroclus, he forms the closest of bonds. As a young man, Achilles ventures forth into the world, where he proceeds from one exploit to the next, vanquishing all manner of opponents until his reputation precedes him far and wide. Then at the very height of his fame and the peak of his physical prowess, Achilles sets sail for Troy to join the likes of Agamemnon, Menelaus, Ulysses, and Ajax in the greatest battle ever fought by men. But somewhere on this crossing, somewhere in the middle of the Aegean Sea,
unbeknownst to Achilles, the widening rays of his life turn their corners and begin their relentless trajectory inward. 10 long years, Achilles will remain on the fields of Troy. Over the course of that decade, the area of conflict will grow smaller as the battle lines draw ever closer to the walls of the besieged city. The once countless legions of Greek and Trojan soldiers will grow smaller, diminishing with every additional death. And in the 10th year, when Hector, prince of Troy, slays the beloved Patroclus, Achilles' world will grow smaller still. From that moment, the enemy with all its battalions is reduced in Achilles' mind to the one person responsible for the death of his friend. The sprawling fields of battle are reduced to the few square feet between where he and Hector will stand, and the sense of purpose that at one time encompassed duty, honor, and glory is now reduced to the single burning desire for revenge. So perhaps it is not surprising that just a matter of days after Achilles succeeds in killing Hector, a poison arrow lofting through the air pierces the one unprotected spot on Achilles' body, the ankle by which his mother had held him when she dipped him in the Styx. And in that very instant, all of his memories and dreams, all of his sensations and sentiments, all of his virtues and vices are extinguished like the flame of a candle that has been snuffed between a finger and a thumb. Yes, for the longest time, Abacus had understood that the great heroic stories were like a diamond on its side. But of late, what had taken up his thoughts was the realization that it wasn't simply the lives of the renowned that conformed to this geometry. For the lives of miners and stevedores conformed to it too. The lives of waitresses and nursemaids conformed to it. The lives of the ancillary and the anonymous, of the frivolous and the forgotten. All lives. His life. His life too began at a point. On the 5th of May in 1890, when a boy named Sam was born in the bedroom of a small painted cottage on the island of Martha's Vineyard, the only offspring of an insurance adjuster and a seamstress. Like any child, Sam's first years were spent in the warm circumference of his family. But one day, at the age of 7, in the aftermath of a hurricane, Sam accompanied his father to a shipwreck that needed to be assessed on behalf of the insurers. Having journeyed all the way from Port-au-Prince, this vessel had run aground on a shoal off West Chop, and there it remained, its hull breached, its sails in tatters, its cargo of rum washing ashore with the waves. From that moment, the walls of Sam's life began to branch outward. After every storm, he would insist upon going with his father to see the wrecks, the schooners, the frigates, the yachts. Whether blown upon the rocks or swamped by a turbulent tide, Sam did not simply see a ship in distress. He saw the world the ship embodied. He saw the ports of Amsterdam, Buenos Aires, and Singapore. He saw the spices and textiles and ceramics. He saw the sailors who hailed from every seafaring nation around the globe. Sam's fascination with shipwrecks led him to fantastical stories of the sea, like those of Sinbad and Jason. The fantastical stories led him to histories of the great explorers, his worldview widening with the reading of each additional page. Eventually, Sam's ever-growing love of history and myth brought him to the ivy-colored halls of Harvard, and then to New York, where, having rechristened himself Abacus and declared himself a writer, he met musicians, architects, painters, financiers, as well as criminals and derelicts, too. And finally, he met Polly, that wonder of wonders who brought him joy, companionship, a daughter, and a son. What an extraordinary passage were those first years in Manhattan, when Abacus experienced firsthand the omnivolent, omnipresent, omnifarious widening that is life. Or rather, that is the first half of life. When did the change come? When did the outer limits of his world turn their corner and begin moving inexorably toward their terminal convergence? Abacus had no idea. Not long after his children had grown and moved on, perhaps. Certainly before Polly died.
Yes, it was likely at some point during those years when, without their knowing it, her time had begun to run out, while he, in the so-called prime of life, went blithely on about his business. The manner in which the convergence takes you by surprise, that is the cruelest part. And yet it's almost unavoidable. For at the moment when the turning begins, the two opposing rays of your life are so far from each other, you could never discern the change in their trajectory. And in those first years, as the rays begin to angle inward, the world still seems so open, you have no reason to suspect its diminishment. But one day years after the convergence has begun, you cannot only sense the inward trajectory of the walls, you can begin to see the terminal point in the offing, even as the terrain that remains before you begins to shrink at an accelerating pace. In those golden years of his late 20s, shortly after arriving in New York, Abacus had made 3 great friends, 2 men and a woman. They were the hardiest of companions, fellow adventurers of the mind and spirit. Side by side, they had navigated the waters of life with a reasonable diligence and their fair share of aplomb. But in just these last 5 years, the first had been stricken with blindness, the second with emphysema, and the third with dementia. How varied their lot, you might be tempted to observe, the loss of sight, of lung capacity, of cognition, when in reality the 3 infirmities amount to the same sentence, the narrowing of life at the far tip of the diamond. Step by step, the stomping grounds of these friends had shrunk from the world itself, to their country, to their county, to their home, and finally to a single room, where blinded, breathless, forgetful, they are destined to end their days. Though Abacus had no infirmities to speak of yet, his world too was shrinking. He too had watched as the outer limits of his life had narrowed from the world at large, to the island of Manhattan, to that book-lined office in which he awaited with a philosophical resignation the closing of the finger and thumb. And then this extraordinary turn of events. A little boy from Nebraska appears at his doorstep with a gentle demeanor and a fantastical tale. A tale not from a leather-bound tome, mind you, not from an epic poem written in an unspoken language, not from an archive or Athenaeum, but from life itself. How easily we forget, we in the business of storytelling, that life was the point all along. A mother who has vanished, a father who has failed, a brother who is determined, a journey from the prairies into the city by means of a boxcar with a vagabond named Ulysses, thence to a railroad track suspended over the city as surely as Valhalla is suspended in the clouds. And there the boy, Ulysses, and he, having sat down by a campfire as ancient as the ways of man, began. "It's time," said Ulysses. "What's that?" said Abacus. "Time? If you're still coming." "I'm coming," he said. "Here I come." Rising to his feet, in a copse of woods 20 miles west of Kansas City, Abacus scrambled through the underbrush in the dark, tearing the pocket from his seersucker jacket. Breathlessly, he followed Ulysses through the break in the trees, up the embankment, and into the boxcar that was destined to take them who knows where. Billy. Emmett was asleep. Billy could tell that Emmett was asleep because he was snoring. Emmett didn't snore as loudly as their father used to snore, but he snored loudly enough that you could tell when he was sleeping. Quietly, Billy slipped out from under the covers and climbed down onto the rug. Reaching under the bed, he found his backpack, opened the upper flap, and removed his army surplus flashlight. Being careful to point the beam at the rug so he wouldn't wake his brother, Billy switched the flashlight on. Then, removing Professor Abernathy's compendium of heroes, adventurers, and other intrepid travelers, he turned to chapter 25 and took up his pencil. If Billy were going to start at the very beginning, he would go back to the 12th of December, 1935, the day that Emmett was born. That was 2 years after their father and mother had married in Boston and moved to Nebraska. It was during the Depression, and Franklin Roosevelt was president, and Sally was almost 1 year old. But Billy wasn't going to start at the very beginning. he was going to start in medias res. The hard part, as Billy had explained to Emmett in the train station in Lewis, was knowing where the middle was. One idea that Billy had was to start on the 4th of July, 1946, when he and Emmett and their mother and father went to Seward to watch the fireworks display. Billy was just a baby at the time, so he couldn't remember what the trip to Seward had been like. But one afternoon, Emmett had told him all about it. He had told Billy about their mother's love of fireworks, and the picnic basket in the attic, and the checkered cloth that they would spread on the lawn in the middle of Plum Creek Park. So Billy could use what Emmett had told him in order to describe the day exactly as it was. But he also had the photograph. Reaching into his backpack, Billy removed the envelope that was in the innermost pocket. Opening the flap, he slipped out the photograph and held it near the flashlight's beam. It was a picture of Emmett, Billy in a bassinet, their mother, and the picnic basket, all in a row on the checkered cloth. Their father must have been the one who took the picture because he wasn't in it. Everyone in the picture was smiling, and though Billy's father wasn't in the picture, Billy could tell that he must have been smiling too. Billy had found the photograph together with the postcards from the Lincoln Highway in the metal box that was in the bottom drawer of their father's bureau. But when Billy had put the postcards in the manila envelope so that he could show them to Emmett when Emmett returned home from Salina, he had put the photograph from Seward in a different envelope. He had put it in a different envelope because he knew that memories of the trip to Seward made his brother angry. Billy knew this because his brother had become angry when he had told Billy about the trip to Seward, and he had never told Billy about it again. Billy had saved the picture because he knew that Emmett wouldn't always be angry with their mother. Once they had found her in San Francisco, and she had had the chance to tell them all the things that she'd been thinking in the years that they'd been apart, Emmett wouldn't be angry anymore. Then Billy would give him the picture, and he would be glad that Billy had kept it for him. But it didn't make sense to start the story there, thought Billy, as he returned the picture to its envelope, because on the 4th of July, 1946, their mother hadn't even left yet. So that night was closer to the beginning of the story than it was to the middle. Another idea that Billy had was to start on the night that Emmett hit Jimmy Snyder. Billy didn't need a photograph to remember that night, because he had been there with Emmett, and had been old enough to remember it himself. It was on Saturday, October 4th, 1952, the last night of the fair. Their father, who had gone with them to the fair the night before, decided to stay home on Saturday. So Emmett and Billy had driven there together in the Studebaker. Some years, the temperature at the fair can feel like the beginning of fall, but that year, it felt like the end of summer. Billy remembered, because as they drove to the fair, they had their windows rolled down, and when they arrived, they decided to leave their jackets in the car. They had left for the fair at 5 o'clock, so that they could get something to eat and go on some rides and still have time to find seats near the front of the fiddling contest. Emmett and Billy both loved the fiddling contest, especially when they had seats near the front. But on that particular night, even though they had plenty of time to spare, they never did get to see the fiddlers. It was while they were walking from the carousel to the stage that Jimmy Snyder began to say his mean things. At first, Emmett didn't seem to care what Jimmy was saying. Then he began to get angry, and Billy tried to pull him away, but Emmett wouldn't go. And when Jimmy tried to say one last mean thing about their father, Emmett punched him in the nose. After Jimmy fell back and hit his head, Billy must have closed his eyes, because he didn't remember what the following minutes looked like. He only remembered how they sounded, with Jimmy's friends gasping, then calling for help, then shouting at Emmett as other people jostled around them, and then Emmett, who never once let go of Billy's hand, trying to explain what had happened to one person after another until the ambulance arrived. And all the while, the calliope and the carousel playing its music and the rifles at the rifle range going pop, pop, pop. But it didn't make sense to start the story there either, thought Billy, because the night at the fair was before Emmett had been sent to Salina and learned his lesson. So it, too, belonged in the beginning. To be in medias res, thought Billy, there should be just as many important things that have happened as important things that haven't happened yet. For Emmett, that meant that he should already have been to Seward to watch the fireworks, and their mother should already have followed the Lincoln Highway to San Francisco. And Emmett should already have stopped working on the farm in order to become a carpenter. And he should already have purchased the Studebaker with his savings. And he should already have grown angry at the fair and punched Jimmy Snyder in the nose and been sent to Salina and learned his lesson. But the arrival of Duchess and Woolley in Nebraska, and the train ride to New York, and the search for the Studebaker, and the reunion with Sally, and the journey they were about to take from Times Square to the Palace of the Legion of Honor in order to find their mother on the 4th of July, all of these things shouldn't have happened yet. That's why Billy decided, as he leaned over Chapter 25 with his pencil in hand, that the perfect place to start the story of Emmett's adventures was when he was driving home from Salina in the front seat of the warden's car.